This is San Diego, California, 20 minutes drive from the Mexican border, home of countless top-line research establishments, base for the US Navy and squadrons of aircraft. And this week, the headquarters of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and its annual meeting, going since 1848. Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and you're on ABC Radio National. In a few minutes, something that seems incredible, how dolphins could help us solve the problem of human diabetes and how so many of us came to get it in the first place. Something else that seems unlikely, how motor cars can be the backup for the electric grid and lead the way for renewables.
And what I want to talk about is a historic event that happened in November of last year. A car called the Magic Vehicle, Mid-Atlantic Grid Interactive Car Consortium, which is made up of the University of Delaware, AC Propulsion, PJM, Pepco Holdings, and Converge, and a couple of associate members, actually has one car, and now three cars, making money in the grid. It is actually collecting cash for the time it's in. I don't believe that's happened anywhere else in the U.S. I don't think it's happened anywhere else in the world.
That's Kenneth Huber of PJM Interconnection announcing it's actually happening. Take electric power off the grid at night when it's cheap, give it back when the grid needs a boost, and your car becomes the reserve needed when demand increases.
So we now have, on a daily basis, whenever the cars are plugged in at the University of Delaware, them making cash. So let me spin back 3 years in time, back to October of 2007. Dr. Kempton and the folks at University of Delaware and the Magic Consortium plugged the car in for the first time, and it started responding to our frequency regulation signal that we send every 4 seconds to the vehicle. It responds by charging and discharging whenever we're asking for more power or less power in the grid. That has gone on for 2.5 years with fantastic learnings, both from how to analyze the driver characteristics and from the grid perspective, what is the value of a single car? But what happens now is let's aggregate that car. And if we had 300-400 vehicles, I'm sure the University of Delaware would aggregate them. We would have what we need in the grid, which is 0.5 megawatt of capacity. So an aggregation is very critical to this vehicle being put in the grid. We didn't have 300-400 vehicles, but we did have a stationary battery system of 1 megawatt. So now in the market, in PJM's market, making money every day is not 1 megawatt, but 1.018 megawatts, counting the car, and the stationary batteries are making money, and the cars are making money at the same time. So it's quite an event. We're very happy to have it happen in the PJM territory, and we'll talk more about it in the future.
Ken Huber of PJM Interconnection, Pennsylvania, and I shall take you to meet one of the electric cars later on in this science show. And the Australians also made a big splash at the AAAS in San Diego, announcing with a paper published through the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science how the no-fish zones on the Great Barrier Reef have performed. And the news is brilliant. Terry Hughes of Townsville.
So the paper, which is about to be published, is a summary of the work of 21 people from lots of different institutions working on tropical reefs. And basically, it's a success story. So the paper documents a doubling of fish biomass inside these new no-take fishing zones, so-called green zones, in less than 5 years. And that's really quite remarkable.
It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? And I suppose from the fishers' point of view, what they get is not simply a doubling in the exclusion zone, which doesn't allow them in by definition, but presumably outside the immediate area of the no-fish zone as well.
Well, that's right. There are more fish inside the exclusion zone, and they're bigger and fatter. And that's important because big fish produce disproportionately more babies. And those larval fish are dispersed far outside the no-take zones into the area where fishing is still ongoing.
Was it with any pattern? Did you find that some fish did better than others?
Well, obviously the targeted fish are the ones that are responding because before the rezoning, typically in the older green zones, there was about a five-fold difference in the numbers of fish. So the zones where fishing is occurring are quite depleted, not by world standards. There's still a lot more fish on the Great Barrier Reef compared to just about anywhere else. But there's a huge difference between the green zones and the blue zones, the zones where fishing is allowed and isn't allowed.
So presumably you can imagine this is a continuing effect. which may in fact increase, or do you think you've reached a kind of ceiling?
No, this is very much at the early stage of the recovery of the fish populations inside the new green zone. So we've seen a doubling in less than 5 years, and we can expect that to go on. We're not quite sure how much more it will increase by, but I won't be surprised if it doubles again in the next 5 years.
So it might even double again in the next 5 years, which really has huge implications for policy. I understand that there is a move possibly to get the Coral Sea made into a similar sort of no-fishing zone, and that's a gigantic area, which is, you know, three times bigger even than the one in the Barrier Reef.
That's right. The issues in the Coral Sea are quite different from the Great Barrier Reef. Obviously, it's further offshore, so the fishing pressure there is negligible at the moment. And for that reason, it's one of the last few places on the planet where you've got intact populations of big megafauna, things like pelagic sharks, reef sharks, big populations of turtles, sailfish, billfish. All the big things are still there in reasonable shape, whereas in the Great Barrier Reef, they're quite depleted. And one thing we've found in our study is that the network of small zones on the Great Barrier Reef is quite effective for reef fish, but it only has a negligible impact on the recovery of the megafauna, the turtles and dugongs and sharks, which remain quite depleted. So having a very large exclusion zone directly seaward of the Great Barrier Reef, I think, would be of benefit to the Great Barrier Reef as well as to the Coral Sea.
Yes, incidentally, at this conference, I actually heard somebody say that, talking about sharks, the great white shark, they said there are as few great white sharks as there are tigers, but people don't appreciate that fact.
You know, that's right. The megafauna everywhere, to a lesser extent in Australia than most places, is severely depleted, and almost by definition, they're slow-growing, slow reproducers. They have a life history like people, so they take a long time to reach sexual maturity. They have relatively few babies compared to, say, small fish, and they're very prone to even small amounts of fishing.
Okay, the overall implications, do you think that this example will convince the people who've been hesitant about applying this sort of no-fish zone in the future?
Well, the Great Barrier Reef is a global icon for how to do it properly in terms of looking after the marine environment. So people here in the States are really just starting their national efforts to improve governance of marine resources. So there's a huge amount of interest in the Great Barrier Reef story.
Terry Hughes is director of the ARC Centre for Excellence for Coral Reef Studies in northern Queensland, standing in windy San Diego. And I saw Professor Hughes sharing his good news with Dr. Jane Lubchenco, one of Professor Obama's top scientific appointments. She's head of NOAA.